Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host Talks with Authors, Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites, featuring Ilya Shapiro. Ilya is a senior fellow and director of Constitutional Studies at the Manhattan Institute. He has previously served as executive director and senior lecturer at the Georgetown Center for the Constitution, as well as vice president of the Cato Institute, directing its Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies. Our moderator today is Ken Marcus. Ken is the founder and chairman of the Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law and former assistant U.S. Secretary of Education for Civil Rights. He's also the chairman of the Federal Society's Civil Rights Practice Group. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Ken, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco, and Ilya, great to see you. I'm thrilled to be with Ilya Shapiro today. Those of us who are long familiar with his tweets are glad to see he's writing books as well, including this great one, Lawless, that we'll speak about. Ilya recently has become quite celebrated for his commentary about law schools and legal education. But for those of us who've been following him for years, we know that he is a versatile constitutional lawyer who has written about any number of different topics. And there certainly have been Junes or Octobers when the Supreme Court is starting or finishing a term where it seems that Ilya had been on TV every day talking about a different case. He edited, I believe, 11 issues of the Supreme Court review and is technically proficient, I would say, in a wide range of issues. So before we get into the legal education topics of his book, Ilya, welcome. Ilya is no stranger. You're no stranger to the Federalist Society. You serve with me on the Executive Committee of the Civil Rights Practice Group, and we're delighted to have you. Thinking back, Ilya, to your time prior to directing the Manhattan Institute, prior to Georgetown Law Center. You have worked on so many different briefs, especially for the Supreme Court. You've edited volumes. You've written on a range of issues. Could you speak to maybe one or two of the either briefs or other things that you've written about that you feel particularly either that they're representative of the work you've done or that you're particularly proud of and would like to discuss before we get into Lawless?
Well, thanks, Ken, and thanks to the Civil Rights Practice Group and the Federal Society for hosting this. I had previously been on the Executive Committee for the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, but we solved all of those issues, so I felt my labors would be better suited for civil rights at this point. That's where a lot of my focus had moved. I wasn't expecting to become have to spend so much time on higher education policy. And I already was a free speech advocate, didn't realize I needed to focus even more on that. But that's how life turns sometimes. I was at Cato almost 15 years. I played a prominent role in coordinating Amici for the challenge to Obamacare. And that's kind of where a lot of my work gained prominence in various venues, the constitutional challenge, which now, you know, the Supreme Court decided that 12 and a half years ago. It's amazing, which means the litigation started. Obamacare was started. We're coming up on the 15th anniversary. And I think there are some classes still that are taught at law schools, all of constitutional law within that, you know, all those things that were raised in that litigation. It was really fascinating. Any one brief, you know, when people introduce me and they say that I've written more than 500 briefs for the Supreme Court, that's not quite accurate. I've filed that many. I've been fortunate to put together very good teams at Cato, now at the Manhattan Institute of Junior Lawyers, and kind of strategize about this stuff in the unique kind of appellate boutique that I've been able to run at these think tanks. A series of briefs that stand out is our so-called funny briefs, the satirical briefs, making fun of speech restrictions of various kinds. I think it started about 12, 14 years ago, the SBA list versus Dry House case, where Ohio criminalized making false statements, whatever that means, about political candidates or propositions. I don't know how a proposition can be offended, but nevertheless, that was the law. And together with a motley crew of Amici, Nadine Strauss, and P.J. O'Rourke, the late P.J. O'Rourke, great man, my favorite client ever. He was an H.L. Mencken fellow, which is honorary, unpaid at Cato. And I said that he was worth every penny. And he replied that as his counsel pro bono, I was also worth every penny. So anyway, I had a series of about a half dozen at this point satirical briefs, including one, the first, and I think only ever Supreme Court brief with a color beer label printed in it. So we had some fun, not just being, funny for the sake of humor, but to elevate these issues and to bring them to different audiences. Because when you're in this role, and this is to conclude this entree that you've graciously given me, I've been fortunate in my career to work at the intersection of the legal, political, academic world. And so my audience, I mean, any amicus briefs audience is more than just the clerks and judges who read them. It's also the media, supporters, the general public who's interested in these issues. And so anything that can bring prominence while maintaining a high level of intellectual rigor and legal analysis, I think, is worth doing.
Excellent. Excellent. And when you mentioned Obamacare and the legal challenges to Obamacare, it made me think of Randy Barnett, the legendary constitutional law professor at Georgetown Law, whom I assume is an answer to the question, why in the world would Ilya Shapiro want to leave Cato Institute for Georgetown Law in the first place? I take it he is a part of the answer.
Absolutely. I wasn't necessarily looking to leave Cato, but I was having dinner with Randy one night, which whom I gotten, I knew of for a long time, of course, but I really gotten to know well during that Obamacare litigation. I remember one night, I think it was about midnight, I was in my office at Cato on the phone with him as we were developing the very early stages of what became his law review article, Commandeering the People, why it's violates a necessary and proper clause to require the purchase of insurance. But anyway, got close to him then, and we were having dinner one night, October 2021, I guess. And after a couple of bottles of wine, he offered me a job, and I thought, well, okay, I guess I should do this and come to Georgetown. And of course, a few days, as my book covers the whole travail, most people who are on this call are at least slightly familiar with the story. A few days before I was due to take that job as executive director as Randy's Center for the Constitution, which we've since learned is an important center because the rest of Georgetown Law is the center against the Constitution. But a few days before that, I had this controversial tweet, and away we went with my so-called lived experience with the illiberal takeover of legal education.
Randy Barnett got over those glasses of wine. Did he realize that he'd made the offer?
It was still good the next morning. I think we
had an
email to further discussions the next day.
Okay. Very good. So if you'll forgive me, I think you're referring to the following tweet. I think it said something like the following. Objectively, best pick for Biden is Sri Srinivasan, who is solid, progressive, and very smart. Even has identity politics benefit for being first Asian for an Indian American, but alas, doesn't fit into the latest intersectionality hierarchy. So we'll get a lesser Black woman. Thank heavens for small favors, ?
Yeah, this was not in response to Ketanji Brown Jackson's nomination. This was a month before there was a nomination. This was the evening after news of Justice Breyer's retirement leaked. And as you mentioned, it's my job to comment on things that are going on at the court. I'd written this, my previous book, Supreme Disorder, about Supreme Court politics and judicial nomination battles. And so I'd been doing media all day on the Breyer retirement, possible successors. And of course, President Biden had announced that he would stick to his campaign promise to nominate a black woman. And I thought, well, you know, he shouldn't restrict his candidate pool by race and sex. And I began thinking, you know, who, as I was doom scrolling late at night in my hotel room, not a best practice, not recommended. If I was at home, if I wasn't on the road when this was happening, probably none of it would have happened. But I was in my hotel room, nothing better to do before I went to bed, doom scrolling Twitter, and fired off that hot take, which you just read. Now, the merits of it, I stick by to this day. And indeed, 76% of Americans agree that Biden should have considered all possible candidates. At least according to a poll by that rabid right-wing outlet, ABC News. But I didn't phrase that in the best way, of course, you know, the nature of Twitter at the height of cancel culture, no less. And so the next day, then I went to bed, and the next day things exploded. My ideological enemies on Twitter went after me, going after my job, again, that I was about to transition to at Georgetown. And there were 4 days of hell, as I call it, as I felt my entire professional life crumbling before my eyes over a tweet. And then ultimately, Dean Bill Traynor at Georgetown didn't fire me, didn't vindicate me, but instead punted and declared that there would be an investigation by the HR office and the DEI office, which at Georgetown is called the Office of Institutional Diversity, Equity, and Affirmative Action, IDEA. And so I was onboarded, but immediately placed on paid administrative leave. And the investigation, so-called, began, ended up lasting more than 4 months. If it started with 4 days of hell, this was 4 months of purgatory or farce or what have you. At the end of which, some junior associate at WilmerHale, which was the white shoe DC firm brought in to assist Georgetown with their investigation, the junior associate looked at the calendar and realized I had not been employed when I tweeted by Georgetown. And so all of the harassment, anti-discrimination policies that they were using to investigate me didn't apply. And so I was let off on that technicality, which I celebrated that technical victory. But then I read the fine print in the report from the IDEA, from the DEI office, which made clear that anytime I said something in future that offended someone, I'd be creating a hostile educational environment and I'd be back in the Inquisition. And I realized, lamentedly, that I would not be able to do the job I was hired to do, both teaching and kind of inward facing and public commentary on the Constitution and originalism under these circumstances. And so I did what we lawyers call make a noisy exit, published my resignation letter in the Wall Street Journal, as one does, and announced my move to the Manhattan Institute on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox the next night. And away we went.
Mm. So I've observed that when Jewish students at Georgetown Law complain about anti-Semitic speakers who are invited to that law school, the response is that the Georgetown Law School is committed to free speech on its campus. Thoughts on that reply?
Well, it's not just in the context of anti-Semitism, although all of these issues have taken a finer and higher point in our national discussion after October 7th and after the disastrous testimony by the university presidents about anti-Semitism on their campuses in December of 2023. But even as I document in my resignation letter, law professors have tweeted much more inflammatory, outrageous, offensive, if you have some sort of objective scale of offense, things that I have. And they were not from the left, to be clear. And they were not investigated or anything like that. And my point is not that they should have been, but it's free speech for me and not for thee. And in framing the ultimate resolution of my case as kind of this battle between these high values that we hold, free speech on the one hand, equity on the other, I think that's a false choice. And it really means that you don't agree with the vaunted speech and expression policy that you have. And Georgetown's policy on paper, like at most schools, after the fine work that FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, previously in education, has done to get rid of speech codes and have these free speech protective policies. Most policies on paper or on pixels are very good, but they're often observed in the breach, especially at the so-called elite institutions, which again is what caused me to start looking into it and ended up with this book.
Ilya, at the time the tweet came out, your critics insinuated that you were suggesting that Black female judges were inferior. But it seems to me that just looking at the words of the tweet, what you were instead arguing is that from a Democratic perspective, any plausible candidate would have been inferior to the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit at the time. Did members of the Georgetown faculty say, wait a minute, look at the text of what he wrote, where, you know, there was a text, there is a text, look at his words. He's not saying what his critics are insinuating that he's saying. How many faculty members came to your defense and pointed out what you had actually said and how different it was than what we were accused of saying?
Yeah, I had a failure of word usage, not of some sort of normative meaning or anything else. It's quite clear that unless you willfully misread my words with malicious intent, what I said, what I meant was that rather than lesser Black woman, I meant we'd end up with a less qualified Black woman, less qualified than, as I was positing, Sri Srinivasan, the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit. And indeed, you know, the logical proposition is not complicated. If I am suggesting that Judge Srinivasan is the best candidate for a Democratic president, then the whole universe of humanity is less qualified, or what in my hot take at that point, limited character Twitter denomination stated was became lesser. So it was clearly inartfully phrased, and I apologize for my failure of communication, but I think it's would take a willful misreading to have some sort of to impute some sort of racist belief. Indeed, if I had this racist belief, why was it just coming out now in this tweet? As I was, you know, it's just a bizarre kind of alternate universe. And to answer your question directly, not many. Nick Rosenkrantz, I understand, fired off a couple of emails on the faculty listserv. David Cole, who until recently was the legal director of the ACLU and is a Georgetown professor, said I shouldn't be fired. Whatever I meant, he didn't wasn't defending the merit so much. But that's about it. You know, and Randy, of course, in talking to the dean. But that's about it. I didn't even get back channel emails from other law faculty saying I can't make this public, but I support you. Didn't get that. You know, lots of support elsewhere, but your question about the faculty and the outcome is telling. And Jordan, this was not the first time something similar had happened at Georgetown. I detail this in my book. About a year or so, year and a half before my episode, a couple of adjunct professors were on a Zoom that was still being recorded after class, and they were lamenting that the Black students tended to cluster towards the bottom of their grading curve. And they were wondering what they could do about that. One even wasn't even saying anything specific. He was kind of just saying, And they ended up being forced out for those kinds of lamentations. And so, again, I think it's just shows a weakness of leadership from Dean Traynor. He did not, you know, join the barricades with BLM and DEI activists. Most of these deans, university presidents, provosts are not social justice warriors or woke radicals. But he didn't defend free speech values or anything else. He kind of tried to chart a middle course, displaying some of the spinelessness that a lot of these leaders have shown in not standing up for whether it's a spirit of open inquiry, whether it's academic freedom, or other just kind of more basic values, due process, free speech, on which the core mission of universities are based, the classical liberal values, if you will.
Ilya, you not only survived the incident, but you used it as the jumping off point for your analysis of the problems of legal academia in your new book, Lawless. At the time that you resigned, a rather stunning development for those who had been following the situation. You had appeared to have just been victorious and you were being reinstated at Georgetown and you resigned quite publicly. At the time that you did that, did you have in mind that you would use this experience as a basis for the next chapter, as it were, of your intellectual career? Did you have this in mind?
No, not exactly. I mean, my whole career has been based on serendipity. So when I try to be deliberate about planning next steps, like my move to Georgetown, that tends to not work out as expected. And it's more, doing good work and being open to opportunity and identifying opportunity when it presents itself is how I've been successful. And so it's, I had been getting some job offers, some temporary, some more permanent during the imbroglio, the troubles, as some of my friends have coined it. And I had talked to friends at the Manhattan Institute. There was some thinking that at Georgetown, I would become an adjunct scholar or something like that. And then when things came to a head, it was really over that weekend, after I wasn't exonerated, I had a technical victory again, that I wasn't an employee. So there's no jurisdiction, as it were, over me for these policies that they were trying to investigate me with. And so once with counsel and with my wife, who's a better lawyer than any of us, poured through this 10-page single spaced report from the investigation, it became clear that, just going about what I was hired to do, whether teaching about a controversial case like 303 Creative, whether a graphic designer can be forced to create a web page for a same-sex wedding, or commenting in the media about the Harvard UNC affirmative action cases, which were pending at the time. And I would, say something that some people wouldn't like, and away we went. I'd be back in the star chamber. I could not operate in that way. And that ultimately what caused the decision to resign. And at that point, I called up my now colleague, Jim Copeland, at MI, and I said, Jim, hey, can we accelerate and deepen the relationship that we've been planning? What do you think? And Raihan Salam, who I knew already but has become a good friend as the president, thought, look, we could use an amicus program. We could use a constitutional law voice. And we can use someone talking more about national issues. So these are great niches for someone like Ilya to fill. And very quickly, to their credit, I'm very grateful to this. They put together an offer over that weekend, which allowed me to resign, knowing what my next steps would be. But it wasn't pre-planned before the denouement of the investigation.
In your book,
as for the book, HarperCollins actually approached me. Did Substack. I got a Substack out of it, Shapiro's Gavel. The opportunity was ripe. And, I said with my last book, which I wrote when my older sons were 4 and 2, that never again would I write a book with little kids in the house, but man plans and God laughs again. And so this one I ended up doing with our cancellation babies, newborn infants in the house, our twins who are now 2.
So Ilya, speaking of cancellation, there have been other books about cultural rot in academia, books that have discussed cancellation, lack of freedom of speech, DEI, critical race theory, and the like. Your book has, of course, a ripped from the headlines aspect to it, not just for your own case, but the various other stories that you tell. But it's also specific to law school. And so it's a little bit different from some of the other works that have come out. In your mind, what we're seeing in the law schools, is it just a category of what we're seeing in higher education generally? Is it different? Does it relate in some way to the rest of the campus? Is this a topic unto itself, or is it just a particular chapter in a broader topic?
So to be clear, this is not a book about cancel culture as such, or vel non, as lawyers would say. And it's not a book about DEI alone, although that's certainly a big part of the discussion of the broader theme of the illiberal takeover of legal education. And I wanted to focus on legal education because That's what I went through. That's what I know. I speak to a lot, dozens of law schools every year through the Federal Society and other organizations. With the possible exception of medical schools who train doctors for literally life and death situations, most worrying if legal education, the training of lawyers, is being perverted, because these are, after all, the gatekeepers of our legal and political institutions, the future judges, politicians, overrepresentation of lawyers general counsels, prosecutors. I mean, you name it. Lawyers occupy leading positions, whether in government, private sector, nonprofits, or anything else. So while it's bad that English or sociology departments are taken over by the crits, critical studies, critical theory, if that goes into law schools, that's, multiple times exponentially worse. And so while there are some analysis that I do, some research that I turned up that's certainly common to the crisis in higher education more broadly, there are certain things that are unique to the law. For example, as critical legal studies posits, there is no objective truth and all existing institutional structures are illegitimate, that need to be broken down, burnt down, and rebuilt to better reflect some sort of intersectional matrix, well, then the entire, rule of law project is out to sea. And it all becomes might makes right, kind of competing Bolshevisms, if you will. It's a very dangerous, whether you call it postmodern or what have you, theory that trains lawyers to have contempt for their profession, for the law, for the founding structures of our country, for the Constitution, for classical liberal values. This is not a debate between left and right, or in the academic context, this is not the decades old complaint that conservatives have about hippies taking over the faculty lounge at Berkeley in the 60s. Instead, it's this illiberal notion, this privileging of activism over education, this disregard for the truth, for the law, considering everything that's institutionalized to be illegitimate, whether because racist, sexist, an imbalance of economic power or whatever. That's dangerous. And I document all that. And it goes beyond ideology, Ken. There's that part with the roaring back of critical theory, whether critical race theory, critical legal studies more broadly, queer theory, all of these things. The roaring back of that, which we thought when I went to law school in the early 2000s, that's some niche thing that had flared up in the 80s and early 90s and now is, back home with sociology departments or what have you. Well, that came roaring back with the vengeance. And then we had these inflection points with the Obama presidency that worsened race relations, Ferguson, the election of Trump, George Floyd, all of these instances that kind of really threatened America's idea of itself. So the ideology is important, but then it's just as much a story of bureaucracy. And this is the less sexy stuff that doesn't always get told. Now, at any university, there are more non-teaching staff than faculty. In some places, more non-teaching staff than students. I don't know what they're all doing. Well, actually, I do know what they're all doing. In the last decade, all that growth has been in the DEI sector. And so millions and millions of dollars are spent, again, apart from the complaints that we might have about what faculty are teaching and theory and all of that, but to instantiate and orientate and imbue all of these illiberal notions in students, that leads to things like the things that we see above the sea level, the cancellations, the shouting down of federal judges and all the rest of it.
Ilya, as I go into my next question, I'll also invite audience members who care to add any questions they might have in the Q&A box as part of the Zoom. Given, Ilya, the problem that you've just described, are law schools fixable? And if so, what is the way forward?
Well, society-wide, I guess I'm like Brett Kavanaugh. I live on the sunny side of the mountain. I'm cautiously optimistic. It seems like we've passed peak woke, although the battle is by no means won. We have to be vigilant and keep pushing. But in academia, including in legal academia, perhaps we've gotten, you know, past the critical point where it's just a spiraling vortex all the way down. I don't know. We're in the eye of that storm. And I'm an all of the above kind of person. It's not any one kind of reform. We need both pressuring deans and making the logical arguments internally, but we also need external forces and exogenous shocks, if you will, in economic terms, whether that be state legislatures acting to shut down DEI offices in public schools, whether that means state attorneys general investigating the misuse of funds and violations of civil rights, the Federal Department of Education, your successor, whoever that becomes in the next Trump administration at OCR, Civil Rights and Education, investigating all of these universities who are denying free speech rights, who are not protecting students from harassment and intimidation based on ethnicity, religion, background, what have you. You don't need new legislation for all of this stuff. There are strings on federal funds that they're tied to accounting standards or anti-discrimination rules. There are also civil rights protections that can be enforced. It includes federal judges not hiring from places that have bad policies or bad enforcement. I support the movement led by Jim Ho and Lisa Branch, about 14 judges, I think, were declared that wouldn't hire from clerks from Yale and Stanford. Then they expanded that to Columbia after October 7th in the response to anti-Semitism. Again, not to penalize the students that were already there. It's forward looking, but just to pressure those schools. And perhaps most importantly, sunlight. I've come to see, and this is one of the positives that I've come to see in the last 2.5 years since I left Georgetown, just shedding a little bit of light in, you know, one op-ed by my now colleague at the Manhattan Institute, John Saylor, in February of 2023, I believe. He used FOIA to get documents from Texas Tech, which is a public school, saying that they were hiring biologists based on diversity statements. The very next day, the chancellor said, that's not appropriate. We're going to stop doing that. So a lot of these structures, to mix metaphors, are Potemkin villages guarded by paper tigers. There's just not been the institutional will to make the changes. And that's why we need to approach it from all angles, including trustees, alumni. You've seen a lot of alumni action at Penn, for example, after October 7th. So all of these things are important, and alternative institutions for that matter. We don't have other law schools yet, but certainly in undergrads, whether the University of Austin, the new one that just opened its doors to students this school year, or centers within existing schools, centers to teach civics or excellence or what have you. All of these words that some see as coded for white supremacy, but I don't. I see them as coded to the original mission of any institution of higher education.
All good suggestions, including your passing reference to the fact that we don't have alternative law schools yet, which perhaps some will find it a tantalizing.
Part of that, Ken, and I didn't mention this, but part of that is because unlike other disciplines in law, there is only one accreditor, the ABA. And I have a chapter in my book about the ABA and all of its foibles and weaknesses and what have you. I think that's another thing that the Department of Education can do without new legislation is change the rules on accreditation and allow a competition in that regard.
Very good. I'm going to turn to the questions that are starting to come in through the Q&A box. One of our listeners asks, does the remedy have to come from government or should the reforms come from outside of government?
Again, all of the above. I'm a classical liberal. I'm for limited government. I'm for market solutions. But even though I consider the federal role in education to be unconstitutional, we have it, and we have state roles in education as well. And so, again, not to interfere with academic freedom or free speech, not to tell professors or students what they can and can't say in class or otherwise, but in terms of structures, funding DEI, or deciding that some university, this is going to be our engineering focused university, our STEM university, while that's going to be our liberal arts university. They make those kinds of decisions all the time. State legislatures do. They can similarly say, we don't need a Department of Feminist Studies, here, there, and everywhere, things like that. So certainly there is a role for government, but there's a larger role. And especially since so many institutions and so many of these so-called elite institutions are private, there's certainly a role for private stakeholders, alumni, trustees, donors, judges, employers, right? As a lot of law firms got together and told deans in the wake of October 7th that they need to do a better job, that we're not going to be hiring Hamas supporters and things like that. So there's a lot of room for the private sector. It would be a lot better if those outside of government would take a leading role in pressuring law schools to change.
One audience member going by the name of Anonymous Attendee asks, how can these problems be effectively addressed in light of the tenure system?
Well, some of these problems are not related to faculty. So the bureaucratic bloat is not about anybody who's tenured, faculty or otherwise. So that's something that certainly needs to be addressed. Why is, tuition has tripled while non-teaching staff has more than doubled. So there's, issues with student loans are tied into this bureaucratic bloat phenomenon. Tenure, I don't have actually strong feelings on one way or another. If anything, tenure protects minority views, which in the academic context means classical liberal, conservative, libertarian, non-progressive, heterodox views. So in a sense, it's not, it's not tenure, the having it or not having it, that would drive what kind of faculty are hired, whether there's ideological or viewpoint based discrimination in hiring or admissions for that matter. So tenure, might be an issue with deadweight faculty. That is, they get tenure and they never publish anything again. It might be a waste of money that way. But in a lot of places, tenure is either irrelevant or it actually protects people who are trying to go against the grain.
I had shared some of the conservative concerns about tenure until a friend who's on a law school faculty said that if tenure were eliminated, I would be the first one to go, because she was the conservative on the faculty and would be an early target. I found that persuasive, and it sounds as if you have similar thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, Amy Wax at University of Pennsylvania Law School was recently subject to, quote unquote, severe sanctions. If she had not had tenure, I imagine she just would have been fired right away.
And there might be no conservatives in legal academia at all. Question, do you see a continuing long-term war over these issues, or do you see one side, we hope yours, more or less prevailing?
This is one of these Rumsfeldian unknown unknowns, or maybe it's a known unknown. I'm not sure exactly on the rubric, but we're in the eye of the storm, and things can shift very quickly, whether you call it a vibe shift or actual organizational shift. So Heather Gerken, the dean at Yale, for example, where a lot of bizarre negative escapades have taken place, from shout downs to just, I think almost an entire chapter is about Yale, our so-called number one law school. And she realized that things had gotten off the rails a little bit. And given that, again, the deans, university leaders are generally careerist bureaucrats. They are not activist radicals themselves. And so she, wanting to make the next step up the greasy pole and become a university president, whether at Yale or at her undergraduate alma mater and mine, Princeton, Harvard, where else? So she said, I needed to improve this, hired Keith Whittington, gave him a bunch of money to have this new center on academic freedom and free speech. Also hired junior faculty, a former Alito clerk. Oh my gosh, someone who clerked for, the justice who wrote the opinion overturning Roe v. Wade is now a professor at Yale. Well, so whether Jim Ho's boycott or these other just bad publicity, this is all connected. And so I have no idea how to predict the future. But the battle has to continue. It's not a 1 year thing. It's not a 2 year thing. It's not a, you know, we're past peak woke. We're past the pandemic that addled so many minds and all these Zoom things that made interactions weird. No, no, no. It has to be sustained effort if we're going to reform them. And it could be that some institutions will be reformed and others will not. There's no, you know, the T14, as the U.S. News rankings call them, there's no, you know, law that that has to be, that has to remain constant.
What would you say to those conservatives who agree with you that we need to implement strong free speech measures in the law schools and elsewhere, that we need to have the kind of open debate and disagreement and dialogue that you encourage, but who think that it's almost too late in the sense that these faculty and even to some extent the student body are so overwhelmingly of one side of the political spectrum that you're not going to have any more the same benefits from robust debate because it's a debate between the left and the left. How do you respond?
The left and the, sometimes the left hand doesn't know what the far left hand is doing, right? That may be correct. You know, I'm not saying that that's wrong. And in many schools, that may well be absolutely correct. But look, there are market opportunities for savvy deans, for savvy university leaders. Just like the chancellor of Vanderbilt, David Diermeier, has gotten national plaudits simply for enforcing the rules that are already on the books, for kicking students out that occupied his office. You know, it's a very low bar. Or Bob Zimmer at University, the late Bob Zimmer at University of Chicago, not firing my friend and colleague Dorian Abbott, a geophysicist who criticized affirmative action. These are very low bars for what you have to do to be seen as a leader and gain a lot of market share, whether it's students, faculty, what have you. I mean, forget the current debate. Elena Kagan, when she was dean of Harvard, Harvard was, you know, this was when I was in college, and I knew friends that were going off to law school, and the ones who went to Harvard were all miserable. And so, and also there was, you know, ideological conformity. So Elena Kagan introduced ideological diversity in faculty hiring and made student life better. And Harvard improved mostly. There's a similar dynamic at UVA. Anyway, there's, you know, whether you're talking about the elite schools or others, there are real opportunities to gain what deans care about: better, higher qualified students, better faculty, more donations. By doing the right thing, not because it's the right thing, but because it makes for a better law school product. And I'm hoping that that is the mechanism that drives change at all these places. I'm not hoping for, you know, conversions on the road to Damascus by all of these careerist bureaucrats.
Well, that might be the model at George Mason University, where I serve on the Board of Visitors, where there has relatively been considerably more intellectual diversity, and where the law school, Scalia Law School, has steadily climbed the rankings, and where more and more students are getting federal clerkships and other indicators of success.
Absolutely. And Scalia Law has long punched above its weight because it gets to hire professors who by all rights should be at higher ranked schools. But because of the ideological discrimination, they don't get those opportunities. And so Scalia Law is just a fantastic institution here, just down the road from where I am in Falls Church, Virginia.
Another question: what division would be the hammer for enforcement of the law? Would it be federal funds?
Well, it's cooperative. Maybe you should speak to this question because you've used it. You have practical lived experience with this, Ken, at the Office of Civil Rights and Education, the Civil Rights Division at DOJ. Congressional committees, of course, have lately been active. I testified before the Education Committee a couple of years ago on tying federal funds to speech. Again, you don't need new legislation. There was legislation proposed, but there are all sorts of strings that allow investigations and ultimately, if there's a finding of violation, withholding of federal funds for not allowing free speech or other civil rights. And so there are different agencies that have authority here.
So since you've asked, I'll say I agree with that. I do think that there are agencies like Office for Civil Rights and the Justice Department that do have an ability to deal with some of the extreme problems. But that what you're talking about in terms of fundamental problems in the law schools and higher education really require much more than that. And that's why I think that some of the maybe bigger solutions that you discussed involving necessarily trustees, directors, and the like are going to be important, because at the end of the day, it's not just about administrators. It's not just about policy. It's about the faculty. It's about the curriculum. It's about the miseducation, to borrow a term, within the universities and law schools.
Yep. And I should, in interest of full disclosure, say that I'm on the board of Florida Polytechnic University. It was appointed about a year and a half ago by Governor DeSantis, and part of his push to improve governance of higher education in his state. And this is something that some governors are waking up to, that regardless of whether they're Republicans or Democrats in the past, these trustee spots have been allocated to friends and cronies and donors and what have you. And then in turn, the trustees, again, regardless of their nominal political valence, are most interested in nostalgia days and tickets to football and basketball games. And if you want to improve higher ed, there simply has to be a more productive attitude, both on the from the perspective of the governors and the trustees.
We seem to have multiple audience members named Tom Palmer. I read from one of them earlier. Here's another question from a Tom Palmer. The media, biased as they are today, play a huge role in shaping or misshaping public opinion, and they are largely responsible for this illiberal trend. Will they ever go back to objectively reporting both sides, in your opinion?
Well, it depends what going back means. I mean, we're not going back to three channels and, you know, Walter Cronkite and two others. You know, what I grew up with in the 80s and 90s, it was Peter Jennings, Dan Rather, and Tom Brokaw. And I can name those off the top of my head. I don't think of myself as that old. Now I have no idea who the leading anchors are for the major networks. They're just not as important. We're not going back to that. And also the so-called mainstream media, is changed. It's, you know, Twitter, X, as it's now called, is many people's, largest source of news. At least for Gen Xers and older millennials. I'm told that for people even younger, they get their news from Instagram and, you know, TikTok, or battling about that, and Chinese influence there, the argument at the Supreme Court later this week, in fact, about TikTok and other, you know, social media and other alternative media. So there's not some deus ex machina that is going to be controlling or editing so-called disinformation or misinformation from either the left or the right. And there shouldn't be. You know, the last thing I want is another government commission. Again, whether it's stacked by, you know, DeSantis or Trump appointees or, you know, Biden or Harris appointees. No, I don't want government commissions telling me what the news should be. So, just the nature of the digital revolution means that the way we, consume news is going to be different. And those outlets that are not trusted are going to decline in value, or they're just going to be speaking to the echo chamber, not ever going to be, you know, convincing anybody.
Another questioner: would it be more feasible to terminate the Department of Education rather than try to reform it? It was started by a socialist, John Dewey. I guess we're not supposed to speak ill of Jimmy Carter this week, so we'll just blame it on John Dewey.
Well, Jimmy Carter had some deregulation, so that was to the good. I think the Department of Education probably should be disbanded, and the small parts of it that are constitutional or at least temporarily necessary can be either doled back to the states or handled by separate other agencies. But I don't know of any educational metrics in either K-12 or higher ed that have improved since the advent of the Department of Education, or that correlate positively with the budget of the or staff numbers of the Department of Education.
As to give a follow-up, would you be concerned if the Education Department were terminated that there would be fewer tools in the federal government that could be used to address illicit use of DEI, critical race theory, infringements on freedom of speech and the like?
Well, presumably that would entirely then shift to the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. Maybe certain others, depending on in the Treasury with regard to student loans, depending exactly on how those responsibilities would be doled out. But I think the functions are that it's not unconstitutional to enforce federal civil rights. So that function, I think, would remain where, presumably with DOJ.
What recommendations do you have for law school graduates who have not become members of the bar yet?
Don't martyr yourselves. I mean, it's the lesson that I've learned from my experience, cancellation attempt. I wasn't canceled. They tried to cancel me. I canceled them. Is not that you need to, put your head above the parapet for every perceived injustice that you see. Be strategic about it. And sometimes that means, parroting to the professor exactly what he or she wants to hear in a given exam, because you're playing the long game. Your goal is not to, be known in your law school cohort as the big martyr or the big activist, but to be successful yourself. And there's strength in numbers. In a lot of these places, the students who are in battle don't realize how much support they actually do, not just members of the Federalist Society or other heterodox organizations, let's say, but the silent plurality, if not majority, who are just trying to keep their heads down to avoid the cancellation crossfire. So you have to be strategic, do well, study hard, and choose good mentors and figure out what the career path makes sense for you by looking at people whose jobs you think you might want 5 years, 10 years further out, contacting them and getting their advice.
And if they're sufficiently brilliant and hardworking, perhaps they'll consider applying to the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights under Law, where we're always looking for good law school graduates.
The Manhattan Institute has internships, both virtual and in New York during the school year, and even more in the summer as well. Occasionally, we'll hire someone fresh from law school or a year out or something like that. It's situational. So as I develop my empire within MI, you should apply there as well.
Manhattan Institute is an excellent institution. I'm glad to hear about your empire building. To what extent are law schools affected by the administrative bloat in the rest of the university? And to what extent are these bureaucrats the source of the ills that you are describing?
I have a whole chapter on the bureaucracy, and the law school or any school, any division within a university typically has replicated within it the overall university structures, whether that be for generic student services or DEI or what academic support or whatever else. And law schools are a profit center for most universities. Law school costs a lot. And so they tend to have more bureaucrats per capita. Because they can afford them. And a lot of this, even without the DEI stuff from the last 10 years, there were lots of people who were added to kind of hold students' hands as they, process the traumas of election results that don't go their way and things like that. I mean, it's ridiculous. These are law students at elite places that need time off, it's mental health days. They can't deal with political news or what have you. But and nonetheless, there's this kind of safetyism and therapizing that has quite apart from the postmodern theory with respect to identity, polluted administrative capabilities. Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt have written about this, the coddling of the American mind and then the cancellation of the canceling of the American mind. So, getting rid of those kinds of bureaucracies would be not just a cost savings, but it would actually be a net plus for the student experience. And admissions officers, we haven't talked about this, but I don't lay all of the blame with DEI deans or head deans for that matter. The admissions offices, again, especially at your Yales and Stanfords, that put a thumb on the scales for activists or those who say, in their letter, their application statement, I want to change the world and I want to transform these structures, what have you, rather than those who say, I want to be a prosecutor of childhood sex crimes, or I want to be a partner at a big law firm to help the next generation of free enterprise be more efficient to grow the American economy, things like that, ho-hum. But if you want to burn it all down, you don't believe the law is legitimate, then, come right on in. So admissions departments, offices, bear some blame.
Just a few minutes remaining. So many people have had questions, and I'm glad we at least got a few of them. But let me ask this question. If the notion of, as you put it, objectively best picks are not a sore point, let me ask you, with a new president coming in, who do you think the objectively best picks would be in the event that there were a Supreme Court opening over the next few years?
Well, I put out a list in September on my Substack, Shapiro's Gavel, of 25, and I had a cutoff of 55 years old because there's only been one person confirmed older than 55 in the last 53 years now, and that was Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was 60 in 1993. So 55 is effectively the cutoff, which loses a lot of fantastic candidates like Amol Thapar, for example. So there are a lot of good candidates, and I tried to sprinkle in district judges and state judges as well, not just the raft of excellent appellate circuit judges that Trump appointed in his first term. I'm not going to list people because inevitably some will be offended who I don't list off the top of my head on the spot there, but you can check out my list from I think early September at Shapiro's Gavel.
Probably just
I will make a prediction. This is not who I think should be on it, but I think my prediction is worth what you're paying for it. But if it's Alito who retires, then his former clerk, Andy Oldham on the Fifth Circuit, is a likely candidate. If it's Justice Thomas who retires, then Jim Ho, his former clerk. There's some symmetry there. I think, again, these are my empirical predictions, not my normative preferences.
Probably just as well you didn't list them. There's at least one person I would have on my list who's watching right now. And if you're a federal appellate judge in the audience, not one of the other ones, but you, we've got some great people here. Let me ask just a couple more minutes left. Say a word about the launch of your book, where you'll be, where we can see excerpts of your book, that sort of thing.
Sure. So it comes out on Tuesday, January 14th. I will be in New York for the launch to be closer to media and because Manhattan Institute is having an event for me. But you can read excerpts. I'm going to be in this Sunday's New York Post. I think that's going to be about the bureaucracy bit. I'm also guest blogging at the Bullock conspiracy. So one post a day for every day next week, 1,200 words, basically distilling five different chapters, more or less. I'm also working on something, negotiating with the Free Press. I just had a piece there on anti-masking, separate from the book, but hopefully something there. And just if you go to my page at the Manhattan Institute website, you can see the different things I've been writing, and of course at my Substack, Shapiro's Gavel.
Excellent. Excellent. Ilya Shapiro, thank you for joining us for what has been a wonderful conversation. In a moment, I'm going to ask Marco to come back, but I'm just going to say on behalf of the Civil Rights Practice Group of the Federalist Society, we appreciate you, Ilya, and we thank everyone who has joined us today. Marco?
Well, I want to second that thank you to both of you for the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federal Society, I'd also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.